Welcome to this recording of the Northwest Expositor Seminar 2023, featuring Kevin Youngblood on the topic Wholehearted, Loving the Difficult God of Deuteronomy, and Everett Hufford on the topic The Glory of God, More About Honor and Character Than Radiance. This seminar was held January 16th, 17th, and 18th, 2023, at Camp Yamhill in Yamhill, Oregon. This is presentation number 5. With Kevin Youngblood, his third presentation. It's titled, The Song of Moses and the Lamb, Difficult Leadership Lessons from Deuteronomy.
All right, well, welcome back. Are we ready to go? Wonderful. Well, what I would like to do in this session is I'd like to finish up just a few things from the previous session that I didn't quite get to kind of wrap up some of these difficulties, these hurdles that your audience is going to have when you present the book of Deuteronomy. There's these objectionable texts that they've been made aware of, and they're going to have questions about them. And so we're thinking about how to frame this in a way to help us get around or over those so that we can hear what God is trying to say through Moses in this text, what the Spirit is saying to the churches in this text. And then we're going to move on to what has been for me a little bit of a surprise is how much the book of Deuteronomy has to say about leadership. I probably should have been aware of that, but it caught me a little off guard. That when I really sat down and looked a little more carefully at Deuteronomy, I was surprised by how moved I was by Moses' leadership. For one thing, I was very moved by Moses' leadership, and then very convicted by things that Moses says about leadership. Because this is Moses' swan song, right? You understand, this is his farewell address to Israel. He's stepping out. He's exiting stage left. And now what? He has, for this generation, remember that the audience Moses is speaking to in Deuteronomy has known no other leadership except Moses. They've known nothing else. This is not the Exodus generation we're talking about that gave him so much trouble, right? This is the generation that adores him and probably adores him too much. And so we're going to notice that the book of Deuteronomy has this repeated refrain about Moses' death. And we'll get to that in a minute. But let's go back for a moment just to talk about a few of these, more of these difficulties. So we've been talking about how to think about these troubling texts, particularly the Canaanite purge, but we're going to talk about some of the others as well. We're just about done with the Canaanite purge, and I think we had gotten right about up to this point. I think I left off with viewing Deuteronomy 7 in the light of the Old Testament's larger theology of warfare, and Deuteronomy's in particular. We talked about Deuteronomy 17, Deuteronomy 20, and this deuteronomic ideal that Yahweh seems to have had, that Israel's approach to warfare was going to be radically different than that of the rest of the nations. They were not going to be reliant on a military complex in the way that other nations were. Their king was not going to exercise his power by that means. And so there's a very different vision. Yahweh recognizes that Israel will need to fight, but it will not be in the way the world fights. And so you get these very interesting and unexpected approaches to warfare that demonstrate that God is setting Israel on a very different trajectory than the rest of the world. And that's important to remember. And we'll come back to the reason for that in a moment. The next point I wanted to make about how to think about this troubling nature of the special kind of warfare that is prescribed for the Canaanites in Deuteronomy 7 is to recognize that this is an ancient Near Eastern text. This is an ancient Near Eastern prescription for war that is modeled after conquest accounts that are fairly well known and well documented in the ancient Near East, and they all share a notable characteristic, and that is exaggerated rhetoric with regard to the thoroughness of the killing and the purging. And K. Austin Younger, whose book I have placed on the bibliography for you, is one who has probably done the most work of any scholar I'm aware of on this issue. His work, Ancient Conquest Accounts, it's the very last item on the bibliography. It's a fairly detailed scholarly work, but you could probably find some more accessible versions of it, if you prefer, in his commentary on Joshua and the New International Version application commentary. K. Lawson Younger actually did the Joshua volume in what we call it NIVAC. You know what I mean, right? NIVAC, the NIVAC commentaries. And there he will give you a kind of a summary of his more detailed work. But if you want to read the more detailed work, what I've placed on the bibliography is where you'll find it. But what he has observed in his comparison of numerous conquest accounts is that it is simply an aspect of the genre, that they use this exaggerated rhetoric. And he says it shouldn't surprise us that Scripture would do that as well. Now, he primarily applies this to Joshua, but I think it applies to Deuteronomy 7 as well, because I think the same kind of exaggerated rhetoric occurs in these prescriptive texts, too. And we're going to look let me just show you an example of one of these. So what you're looking at here is the Meneptah victory stela that is well known, primarily because it's the oldest extra-biblical mention of Israel that we have, that demonstrates that there was an entity named Israel present in the land in the early Iron Age period. But what's interesting to me about this text is what Meneptah claims. Now keep in mind that even in Israel's early days in the land, Egypt still viewed itself as having a claim on Canaan. And so Meneptah is doing these military campaigns into Canaan to try to keep hold of Egyptian control of Canaan, because it's slipping away, and I think Meneptah knows it, right? And so he's been... But listen to what he says in this text. He says, "The princes are prostrate, saying, Shalom. Not one of the nine bows lifts its head. Jehanu is vanquished. Kati at peace. Canaan is captive with all woe. Ashkelon is conquered. Gezer seized. Yanoam made non-existent. Israel is wasted, bare of seed. Kor has become a widow for Egypt. All who roamed have been subdued by the king of Upper and Lower Egypt, Banerah Meramun, son of Re, Merneptah, content with Ma'at, given life like Re every day." All right, now, look at this statement. Really? the obvious problem is that clearly is not the case. Right? Israel was clearly not wasted, bare of seed. But that's the kind of language you get in these victory stela. That's the kind of language you get in these texts. He won, and so he says, "We annihilated them." Right? No, they did not. Clearly they did not, right? And you can see something similar with regard to the outcome of Israel's emergence in Canaan. That there continued to be a Canaanite presence, clearly. And yes, it is certainly true that the historical books that are based on Deuteronomy's ideology blame Israel for not having completed the task. But those remain, I think, examples of the exaggerated nature of these kinds of conquest texts. Final observation. So I've already indicated that we need to think in terms of a hermeneutical trajectory here. That something is starting in Deuteronomy that won't reach its fruition, that won't fully flower or mature until later. And when you have occasions like this, when Israel's in its infancy, and there's a great concern for the sanctity of a people who are very new in their relationship with Yahweh, that certain measures are taken that are not Yahweh's ideal. But Yahweh, nonetheless, plants a seed that will germinate and take root and flower to something later. And we see this in the New Testament. Deuteronomy is not God's final word with regard to the Canaanites. And we need to remember that. And when we come to Matthew's account of Jesus' encounter with this woman that Mark refers to as Syrophoenician, but Matthew, interestingly, straightforwardly calls her Canaanite. And I think that's very deliberate on Matthew's part, because he's wanting to speak to this issue, because I think biblical authors themselves felt what we feel about this this particular chapter of Israel's history. It was difficult to justify. It was difficult to understand in light of some of the things Jesus was teaching. So we come to this text in Matthew 15:21-28. That just gives us a little reminder that God is not finished with the Canaanites. And Matthew's inclusion of this pericope, this story from Jesus' ministry, is very important evidence to that effect.
Excuse me real quick.
Yeah.
What does the NB mean on the last line?
Note well. Nota bene.
Thank you.
Just note well. Sorry about that. Yeah.
That was a good note.
Yes. All right, so, beginning in verse 21 of Matthew 15. And Jesus went away from there and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and was crying. Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely oppressed by a demon. But he did not answer her a word. And his disciples came and begged him, saying, send her away, for she is crying out after us. He answered, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. But she came and knelt before him, saying, Lord, help me. And he answered, it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. She said, yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. Then Jesus answered her, O woman, great is your faith. Be it done for you as you desire. And her daughter was healed instantly. So you see that you kind of you need to follow these trajectories sometimes and see where they end before drawing any rash conclusions about what Yahweh's ultimate intent is for the Canaanites. And gratefully, we have this this helpful little note in Matthew 15 that kind of shows us where this is headed. All right, so next issue to deal with, now that we've dealt with the Canaanite purge, is to talk about the next troubling text in Deuteronomy. At least for me, I think it's the next most troubling text. And that has to do with these restrictions that Yahweh placed on who is and is not allowed in his assembly. And the people that Yahweh chooses to exclude, it's kind of hard to understand, hard to explain. And so we want to take a moment to think about this restricted access to Yahweh's assembly and why Yahweh was doing this and what it means and how we might try to explain it to ourselves as well as to those that we're seeking to teach. Well, let's begin just by understanding what Yahweh's assembly is. When Deuteronomy speaks about this assembly that excludes certain people, what are we really talking about? Well, it's all adult males who are qualified to do the following: to make decisions, to engage in cultic activities, that is to engage in worship, to serve in Israel's military, and you can see some evidence of this in Micah chapter 2, verse 5. Generally speaking, this is an inclusive assembly that we read about elsewhere in Deuteronomy. And you can see just some quick examples of that in 12:7, 12:12, 16:11, and 16:14. I won't take time to read all of those to you, but you can see just the general gist of it there. But when we come to this text in Deuteronomy 23, let's see, let me find it. Yeah, 23. When you come to chapter 23 of Deuteronomy, this is the first time that you encounter some restrictions regarding who may enter this assembly. And here's who's prohibited: emasculated males, as we mentioned at the beginning of our last session. Those born of prohibited unions. Now, obviously, what's troubling about this is that there's nothing to indicate that they could prevent this, that this was not something that was preventable on their part. Right? Now, in some cases, the emasculation might have been. It might have been self-mutilation, because we do know that there were some certain cultic practices that Israel's neighbors engaged in that resulted in castration, that involved castration. as some act of dedication to the gods, or as entrance into a celibate priesthood or something of that nature, or to become a eunuch with some kind of religious function. We are aware of those kinds of things. But there's also birth defects. There's also forced castration, right, where the person involved has no power over this. And so why are those people excluded from Yahweh's assembly? Right? That doesn't seem right. And particularly in a culture like ours, where inclusiveness is the key virtue, this really offends. Those born in prohibited unions, similar, right? They couldn't help that. Why are they prohibited from entering Yahweh's assembly? In addition to these, Ammonites and Moabites. Here, of course, you add the issue of prejudice, don't you? This appearance that there are certain ethnic groups not permitted in. Now, it is interesting to note that both these people groups arise from incestuous relationships explained in Genesis 19, and they're born to Lot, right? These are Lot's sons, and these are descended from Lot. And what's interesting is the way Lot dishonored Abraham. And this is a key point, and I don't want us to miss this. Yahweh made clear in Genesis 12 that the nations were welcome to participate in His blessings, but they had to do it through Abraham. Right? So what God does is God makes Abraham and his descendants the point of contact with divine blessing. The point in electing Abraham is not to exclude the rest of the world, but through Abraham to include them. Through Abraham. Right? Now, when these peoples reject Abraham as the point of contact with divine blessing, what have they done? They have forfeited Yahweh's blessing. Right? This is something that the Ammonites and the Moabites consistently do. They consistently mistreat Abraham and his descendants, and as a result, never seem to recognize that their access to divine blessing depends on their right relationship with Abraham and his descendants. Do you see what Yahweh is preparing us for here? Where does one find God's blessings? In Christ. And so access to those divine blessings are dependent on what? Having a right relationship with Jesus Christ, because Jesus Christ is now that descendant of Abraham who is the point of contact with all divine blessing. He wants to share it with everyone, but they are not available outside of Christ. Right? So this is already being taught in Deuteronomy. And this is a main reason why the Ammonites and Moabites are excluded from the assembly, because they mistreated God's people, and the stories of that mistreatment are retold in detail in Numbers 23 to 24 and 31:16. Particularly Moab here summons Balaam to come and curse Israel. Do you remember this? And God, of course, thwarts that effort and turns each of Balaam's oracles into a blessing instead of a curse. But then after that, the Moabites try to seduce Israel at Baal Peor, an incident that Moses revisits more than once in Deuteronomy and says, don't ever let this happen again. And because of Moab's consistent efforts to be a stumbling block to Israel, to stand in the way of Israel pursuing God's holiness and realizing her promise, they are dealt with pretty harshly in Deuteronomy, but not for no reason. Now, we'll come back to this in a moment and talk about, again, a trajectory. There's a trajectory here, and we don't want to think that this is God's final word with regard to Ammon and Moab. It is not, and I'll show you that it's not. But this is among the prohibited people at this point. So this raises a question that naturally we would ask. What is the point? Why exclude these people from Yahweh's assembly? And Deuteronomy's answer would be, it's the sanctity of the assembly. It is to impress upon Israel the care with which one must enter the divine presence. Something that is emphasized in many places, but particularly in a psalm like Psalm 15. Do you remember Psalm 15 and the question that it poses at the beginning of its hymn? Exactly. Right. So this is a Psalm of David, and it begins like this: O Yahweh, who shall sojourn in your tent? Who shall dwell on your holy hill? And there's criteria for this. Right? There's criteria for this. He who walks blamelessly and does what is right and speaks the truth in his heart, who does not slander with his tongue and does no evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his friend. And I thought getting ready for church was just waking up in time and dressing myself. There's a lot more to getting ready for church than that, isn't there?
Amen.
So that's one of the things that I think Yahweh is trying to impress upon Israel. So here's what we want to be careful not to do. We don't want to make this mistake and think that the point is that there is no admittance for such people at all, but that their point of entry is necessarily different than that of Israel's at this point in redemptive history. They're not allowed to the assembly yet, but look at what happens interestingly. As we continue to read the biblical story, look at what happens. Isaiah does a remarkable thing with these restrictions. Look at Isaiah chapter 56. I love this section of Isaiah. It's just remarkable. Beginning in verse 3, the prophet says, "Let not the foreigner who has joined himself to Yahweh say, 'Yahweh will surely separate me from his people.' And let not the eunuch say, 'Behold, I am a dry tree.' For thus says Yahweh to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths, who choose the things that please me and hold fast my covenant, I will give in my house and within my walls a monument and a name better than sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. And the foreigners who join themselves to Yahweh to minister to him, to love the name of Yahweh and to be his servants, everyone who keeps the Sabbath and does not profane it and holds fast my covenant, these I will bring to my holy mountain. Who shall ascend? The foreigner may, if he keeps the Sabbath, right? The eunuch may." Something is happening here. The restrictions are being lifted. Do you see that? "And make them joyful in my house of prayer," right? And on it goes to talk about just how complete their inclusion is. And then, of course, we see this actually play out in the New Testament with, like, the Ethiopian eunuch, right? In Acts chapter 8, verses 26 to 40, who, by the way, was reading what text? Isaiah 53, right? How much you want to bet that Philip took him from there all the way into chapter 56? And what if he was reading that text we just read when he came upon that body of water? Boy, that would have been the perfect moment for him to ask the question, "See, here is water. What hinders me from being baptized? Why can't I join the assembly?" You can. You can. All right. And then, of course, Ruth's inclusion in Israel. There's a Moabite, right? What's she doing here? She's not supposed to be here, right? This is interesting. I want you to think about this with regard to the book of Ruth. Why would the book of Ruth even have been written? Now keep in mind that the book of Ruth concludes with a genealogy. With whose genealogy? David's. That's interesting because you don't get David's genealogy in Samuel. And that's unusual for a king, right? But you get it in Ruth. Here's what I think is going on. Now you remember that when David first came to the throne in Israel, that Ishbosheth, Saul's surviving son, tried to retain power, right? And so you actually had two kings. So Judah anointed David first at Hebron, but the rest of Israel remained loyal to the house of Saul for a while. So you had a time where there was like these rival kingdoms. Can you imagine the kind of political rhetoric that was going back and forth? Now, if you were Ishbosheth, if you were in the house of Saul, and you were wanting to discredit David so as to maintain the Saulite dynasty, here's a good way to go about doing that. David's a Moabite! He has Moabite blood flowing through his veins. We can't have a Moabite as king of Israel. He can't even enter the assembly of the Lord. Right? Doesn't that sound like a great political hack job? And so now David has to decide how to respond to this accusation. So here's the interesting thing. Whoever wrote the book of Ruth decided to just lean into that. That's right. That's right, David. David does have Moabite blood. Let me tell you about Grandma Ruth. And you tell this beautiful story about this woman of incredible integrity, right? Who converted to Yahweh. You know, the book of Acts is not the only place you'll find conversion stories. What do you call this? Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. That's conversion. So Ruth was a Moabite, right? She's better than most Israelites. And she was allowed into the assembly of Yahweh despite the restriction of Deuteronomy. So something is going on here, right? And then what about Jeremiah 49, verse 6, and his oracle against Ammon? Remember, the Ammonites were the other group that were excluded from Israel. So here's an interesting little thing that Jeremiah says after excoriating Ammon. He gives them a little bit of hope, which is not unlike Jeremiah in his oracles against the nations. He will often do this. And we have such an example with his oracles against Ammon. So Jeremiah 49, verse 6. I can get these pages to... Boy, the thin pages of our Bibles are certainly not easy to turn sometimes, are they? There we go. All right. So after a fairly lengthy oracle of condemnation against Ammon, Jeremiah concludes with this word from Yahweh. But afterward I will restore the fortunes of the Ammonites, declares Yahweh. Even the Ammonites, Yahweh, will return from exile, you see. Now that must, at the very least, we'd have to say, that must mean he has something in mind for them. That Deuteronomy is not the last word. All right, so given that these reversals occur, then why make these restrictions at all? Why make these restrictions only to repeal them later? That's a good question. And I don't know that I have a great answer, but I'll tell you what I think. Once again, we have to remember that Israel is in her infancy and is very vulnerable to the nation's influence and corruption. And this is Yahweh's main concern at this point in time. But this will not always be the case. Now let me take you back in your childhood a little bit and see if you remember something like this. Do y'all remember ever reading a book like this? When I was a little tyke, my parents, my mom in particular, was very heavy-handed about this. Don't you ever talk to strangers. I distinctly remember the ever. Did she really mean that? What was she trying to do? She was trying to protect me from people she knew could harm me. She knew I was too young to have discernment of my own. She knew I was too small to protect myself. And so when I was little, we read books like this. Scared me to death. But if I had not outgrown those instructions, where would I be socially today? Some of you are thinking, did you outgrow those instructions? Yes, thankfully I did. Now, are those instructions necessary? Yes, right? For children, we do need to protect them. But our children are going to grow. And as they grow, we're going to teach them this, aren't we? Let's not underestimate the possibility that Yahweh is doing the same thing with Israel. Deuteronomy here is reflecting Israel at a stage in her existence where she is vulnerable in a way that she will not always be. And so Yahweh does some things that sound harsh to us, that sound exclusionary and prejudicial to us. But remember what Deuteronomy has already said. It is for our good always. Not just Israel's good, the good of the nations too. Because if Israel doesn't remain sanctified, then what happens to the nations, right? If God's people don't remain a channel for His grace and a means by which He can bring His Messiah, then we're all doomed, aren't we? So this is not just for Israel's good. It is, but it's also for the nation's good as well. So that's something worth thinking about and considering, is that Yahweh is cultivating a people here, and in their infancy, He places some restrictions on His assembly that He does not mean to endure indefinitely. I don't know how satisfying an explanation that is for you, but it helps me. All right, so those are the main issues with the book of Deuteronomy. But it brings me to this last one, and this one transitions us into our discussion of leadership. All right, so, you have a bucket list? You have a bucket list? You don't? Most of us do. I have a bucket list, right? I have some things I'd like to do before I kick the bucket. So this is a phrase that entered our colloquial language with the movie, right? Yeah. Remember? That movie with Morgan Freeman and Jack Nicholson, right? Yeah. The bucket list. So here's what you need to understand. Moses had a bucket list. Did you know that? Moses had a bucket list. And guess what was at the very top of Moses' bucket list? Oh, yeah. Exactly. Moses' bucket list, item number one, enter the Promised Land. So, let's take a look at Deuteronomy chapter 3 for a moment and just see kind of what happens here. Because one of the things that is clearly going on in the book of Deuteronomy is Moses is reviewing some disappointment he had with God. And in particular, Moses is reviewing some disappointment we had with God's severity. And this comes up in the book of Deuteronomy in a variety of ways, but one of the most noticeable ways is in how the death of Moses features so prominently in the book of Deuteronomy. It comes up again and again. Just one example is the fact that the death of Moses actually frames the book of Deuteronomy. He mentions it near the beginning of the book in chapter 1, verse 37. I'll begin reading in verse 34. And Yahweh heard your words and was angered, and He swore, not one of these men of this evil generation shall see the good land that I swore to give to your fathers, except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh. He shall see it, and to him and to his children I will give the land on which he has trodden, because he has wholly followed Yahweh. Even with me, Yahweh was angry on your account. Did you hear that? This will not be the last time you hear Moses say this. It's your fault that God is angry with me, right? You also shall not go in there. Joshua the son of Nun, who stands before you, he shall enter, encourage him, for he shall cause Israel to inherit it. And so for your little ones, who you said would become a prey, and your children who today have no knowledge of good or evil, they shall go in there, and to them I will give it, and they shall possess it. But as for you, turn and journey into the wilderness in the direction of the Red Sea. So you see at the beginning here, Moses remembers, you're the reason why I can't enter the land. Now, we're going to come back to that in a moment and talk about Moses' perspective on that and why he blames Israel for that. But it's enough here to say this is clearly anticipating his death. He's going to die before Israel crosses the Jordan and enters the land, right? And that's Moses has some bitterness about that. And you see it in the text a few times. And then, of course, the book of Deuteronomy concludes with the death of Moses. Moses dying outside the land on Mount Nebo. After having surveyed the land, he is then essentially euthanized by Yahweh. Right? You know, Everett was speaking in his last session about the trek up Sinai and thinking, my goodness, that's hard for a young man, much less for an old one, right? But listen what Deuteronomy says about Moses, all right? He didn't die of old age, I can tell you that. Because when Deuteronomy 34 eulogizes Moses, it says some interesting things about him here. This is not a conquest account. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, this is verse 5. So Moses, the servant of Yahweh, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of Yahweh, and he buried him in the valley of the land of Moab, opposite Beit Peor, but no one knows the place of his burial to this day. Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eye was undimmed. He still had 20/20 vision. At 120, that's not bad. His vigor unabated. So that's how he got up and down Sinai, right? So, it's interesting that the book of Deuteronomy wants you to know Moses didn't die of natural causes. He didn't die of natural causes. This was Yahweh's judgment. He was euthanized by Yahweh. And so the book of Deuteronomy is framed by this tragic incident, right? And then the death of Moses punctuates Deuteronomy. Look at how many times it keeps coming up. It comes up again in chapter 3, verses 23 through 27. It comes up again in chapter 4, verses 21 to 22. It comes up again in chapter 18, verse 15, right? Moses says, God will raise up a prophet like me. Well, why? Because Moses is dying. There will have to be a successor. And Joshua will be the beginning of that succession of prophets. Chapter 31, verse 2, chapter 31, verses 14 to 16, and chapter 31, verses 27 to 29. Deuteronomy is apparently obsessed with Moses' imminent death. Now, there's one text in particular that I want to read with you and discuss in this regard that will launch our discussion about difficult leadership lessons that we learn from Moses. And this is Deuteronomy chapter 3, beginning in verse 23. Moses says this, "And I pleaded with Yahweh at that time, saying, O Sovereign Yahweh, you have only begun to show your servant your greatness and your mighty hand. For what God is there in heaven or on earth who can do such works and mighty acts as yours? Please, let me go over and see the good land beyond the Jordan, that good hill country in Lebanon." Oh, how could you say no to that? Moses has served Yahweh faithfully for 40 years in this wilderness. He has put up with a lot from these people. Surely Yahweh can give in a little here. Listen to how Yahweh responded to that prayer. "But Yahweh was angry with me because of you." There it is again, right? Like I told you it would be. "And would not listen to me. And Yahweh said to me, enough from you. Do not speak to me of this matter again. Go up to the top of Pisgah and lift up your eyes, west, north, south, and east, and look at it with your eyes, for you shall not go over this Jordan. But charge Joshua and encourage and strengthen him, for he shall go over at the head of this people, and he shall put them in possession of the land that you shall see." Ouch. "Don't ever speak to me about this again. My decision is final. You will not enter this land." That's disappointing, isn't it? Now, if you want to look at your handout for a second. The first one, the one that you got the first night we were together. And just on the back of the first page, at the very top, you see I have this text there. And I suggest a sermon entitled, "When God Says No, Dealing with the Disappointment of Denied Requests." As leaders who pray a lot, guess what you're going to hear a lot? No. How are we going to deal with that? Particularly when it's a devastating no, like Moses' was. And so I have a suggestion here for how to preach a text that helps you and your people deal with God's no's to your prayers. Some of which will be deafening. Some of which will be devastating. He's going to say no sometimes, and it's going to hurt. And we're going to have to find a way forward. And to Moses' credit, Moses does. And that's what we want to talk about now, is how Moses deals with this disappointment. Now, you may be wondering, well, why is God so unyielding on this? Well, I think it's because the death of Moses is the key object lesson in the book of Deuteronomy. Moses is an object lesson in a number of ways. He's a model of many things, and I want to talk to you about some of the ways in which Moses is a model. But I want to begin with this one. We have to trust God's wisdom when it comes to knowing when it's time to bow out. And I have noticed that leaders are not especially good at this. But Moses was. And so we can learn something from him here. I want you to listen once again to the words of Deuteronomy 34, how the book of Deuteronomy concludes, because it's very instructive here as to why God is doing what he's doing. Then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah, which is opposite Jericho, and Yahweh showed him all the land, Gilead as far as Dan, all Naphtali, the land of Ephraim, Manasseh, and all the land of Judah as far as the western sea, the Negev and the plain that is the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees as far as Zoar. Now, for me, personally, that would have just made it worse. Look at what you don't get to have. And Yahweh said to him, this is the land of which I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to your offspring. I have let you see it with your eyes, but you shall not go over there. So Moses, the servant of Yahweh, died there in the land of Moab, according to Yahweh's word. And he buried him in the valley in the land of Moab, opposite Beit Peor. But no one knows the place of his burial to this day. Interesting. Now, don't tell the Muslims this, because they think they do.
But it's in Judea now.
Yes, yes. Yeah, they took me there. I thought, interesting. All right. Anyway, why would Yahweh not allow Moses' grave to be marked? So they wouldn't turn it into a shrine.
Idolatrize Moses.
Exactly. Because leaders can become idols too, can't they?
Yes.
Which is why they have term limits. Idolatry is, after all, the chief concern of the book of Deuteronomy. But idolatry is not just the obvious things, like images, stone, and statue. Idolatry extends to institutions and to individuals. Moses must die before entering the land, lest he become an idol. You see, yeah?
Do you think we struggle with some of these things because we see death as a final bad thing, and in God's world it's not?
Absolutely. In fact, we're going to get to that in a few minutes here as we see how this plays out. Once again, this is another trajectory, and we're going to have to trace it and follow it and see what happens with it. But yes, I think that's absolutely the case. So that's one of the things that Moses models. Moses models the need to know when to exit for the good of God's people. Know when to exit before you inadvertently raise up a personality cult around yourself. Right? So let's take a look at some other things that Moses models for us that are wonderful tips on good leadership. Another thing that Moses models for us in the book of Deuteronomy is submission to divine discipline. Yahweh said, don't ever ask this again, and Moses didn't. Moses let it go. After chapter 3, verses 23 to 27, Yahweh gives Moses his marching orders, and he says, stop obsessing over the promised land and start preparing your successor. Right? And you know what? That's what Moses does. From this point on, that's what Moses does. So he submits to Yahweh's discipline. He says, okay, I tried. But I accept this. And to Moses' credit, do you know what he does not do? He does not sabotage Joshua. Now, Moses has some bitterness about this, and it comes out in the book of Deuteronomy, but he does not let it poison Joshua's succession. Now, say what you want about Moses, but that's pretty okay in my book, because that doesn't happen very often. That doesn't happen where you get a transition of leadership, where the former leadership bows out graciously and leaves things as good as possible for the next leader. That just doesn't happen that often, right?
Right.
But Moses does that, and he does it well. He does it graciously. He does it splendidly. Moses models dying to personal dreams for the greater good and handling the disappointment graciously. And then, of course, as I mentioned, he refuses to compete either with God's honor. Thank you, Everett. That was glory, but I changed it to honor. Or the success of the leadership replacing him. Let's just look at a couple of examples of where Moses demonstrates this. Deuteronomy 31, beginning in verse 1. So Moses continued to speak these words to all Israel, and he said to them, I am 120 years old today. I am no longer able to go out and come in. Yahweh has said to me, you shall not go over this Jordan. Yahweh your God himself will go over before you. He will destroy these nations before you, so that you shall dispossess them, and Joshua will go over at your head, as Yahweh has spoken. Now that's like cheerleading, isn't it? Do you hear that? Moses says, here's what I think is going to happen in the wake of my exit. I think Yahweh is going to go before you, and I think he's going to destroy these nations so that you can dispossess them, and I think Joshua is going to lead you well as Yahweh does this. Right? He doesn't say, well, I don't know what y'all are going to do about me. Good luck. That's all I can say. Right? He doesn't do that, does he? He says, you know what? I have served at Yahweh's behest. I serve at Yahweh's pleasure. Yahweh is done with me, and I accept that. But he's not done with you. And you're going to succeed. I'm dispensable. I'm dispensable. Right? And then chapter 34, verse 6, another place where you see something similar, a gracious exit by Moses. So this is interesting how Deuteronomy 34 records his death. So Moses, the servant of Yahweh, died there in the land of Moab according to the word of Yahweh, and he buried him in the valley in the land of Moab opposite Beit Peor. But no one knows the place of his burial to this day. I have a question for you. Who buried Moses? No Israelite is supposed to know where Moses is buried. So who buried Moses? It had to be Yahweh. Think about that for a moment. Name one other biblical character Yahweh personally buried. Right?
Jude says not even the devil knows.
It's interesting, isn't it? That Yahweh doesn't want us to misunderstand. Yahweh is not excluding Moses from being a part of his people. Yahweh is not eternally condemning Moses. And he demonstrates that by burying Moses. Because you have to understand, in Israel, that was a very significant act. You were taking responsibility for someone. You were claiming them as family if you set Shiva for them, right? If you buried them, if you took responsibility. You were saying, this one belongs to me, and I will see to it that he is properly laid to rest. That is no small thing. And the final thing we hear about Moses is that he's buried by Yahweh. Yahweh honors Moses this way, right? Because ultimately, Moses honored Yahweh. And which is why that we need not have any question about Moses' fate, as some of the Second Temple literature did. We need not have questions about Moses' fate. Yahweh buried him personally, and that is significant. And of course, you know, Moses is a model of self-sacrificial mediation. On more than one occasion, he stood between Yahweh and Israel and prevented a disastrous altercation. Now, let's go back for a second to Moses' refrain, Yahweh was angry because of me. But, well, Yahweh was angry because of you. He was angry with me because of you. So he says this. I want you to think about, I think this is what Moses is thinking. Forgive me for getting inside Moses' head and psychologizing him. I'm not Freud or anything, but I'm going to try. I think this is what he's thinking. Think about this with me for a moment. If Israel had accepted the gift of the land in Numbers 14, who would have gotten to go in with them? Moses. Because the incident that excluded him didn't happen until after that, right? So I think this is Moses' reasoning here. If you had taken the land when you were supposed to, I would be in it with you. But you forfeited Yahweh's gift, and as a result, you forfeited it for me as well. Now, that's not exactly true, right? Moses has to bear responsibility for his own disobedience and its consequences. But that never prevented leaders before from blaming their flock, right? All right, so anyway. We've already talked about pretty much all of this. But I want just another word about Yahweh bearing Moses. What's so interesting about this is that this is Yahweh's way of saying, look, Moses was not under a curse. I did not subject him to the covenantal curse. Because if you go to Deuteronomy 28, verse 26, this is among the curses that Yahweh promises for those who disobey him and who breach covenant with him. Among the curses he promises to those who disobey is this, and your dead body shall be food for all birds of the air and for the beasts of the earth, and there shall be no one to frighten them away. Right? Exposure. The dead body is left. And there's no one even there to care enough to get the birds away. You just become food for carrion, right? Carrion for the unclean birds. Yahweh doesn't do that, and so you see he's preserving Moses from that curse, so he claims Moses' family by taking responsibility for his burials. You can see in texts like Genesis 23:19, 25:9-10, and 54-6. So a very tender moment in the book of Deuteronomy is after euthanizing Moses, Yahweh buries him, saying, he's good. He's good with me. All right. Now, I want to confess to you that I do not like how the book of Deuteronomy ends. I do not like the way it ends. It's kind of a downer to see Moses dying outside the land. But apparently I was not the only person who didn't like how the book of Deuteronomy ended. Because look at what happens in Mark chapter 9.
Mark chapter 9.
So in Mark chapter 9, beginning in verse 2, we read the story of how Jesus takes Peter, James, and John and leads them up on a high mountain by themselves, and there is transfigured before them. And his clothes become radiant, intensely white, as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah and Moses. And they were talking with Jesus. Where is Moses standing? In the land. What the law could not do, Christ did. He got Moses in. Isn't that something? Two requests Moses made of Yahweh, to which Moses said no. You heard about one of them in Everett's last presentation. Show me your kavod. The other one was, let me see the promised land. Now as Moses stands before Christ, he stands in the land and he is looking into the face of the one with whom he was speaking. Now, no, Moses didn't have the right to request that, but God always has the right to grant it. And he did. Moses saw him. And he saw him in the promised land. God may say no for a while, but he eventually says yes. It's a long time to wait, isn't it? Who needs a bucket list when you can have eternal life? Right? All right. So, I've made my peace with Deuteronomy. That's pretty good ending, right? That's pretty good ending. All right, so now just to cap off a little bit about leadership in Deuteronomy as we sum up a few things, and I draw your attention to one or two other of the sermon starters I've got for you here. So here's some of the things that we can see in Deuteronomy regarding leadership that I just want to highlight briefly before I conclude. The main thing I wanted to do was just trace this theme of Moses and his death and how he handles that and how he graciously prepares the way for Joshua despite the bitter disappointment of not being able to enter the land, and having instead to prepare someone else to do what he so dearly wanted to do. It is to Moses' credit that he accepted that graciously. But here's some other things that happen along the way that are worth noticing. In chapter 1, verse 6, Moses notes that Yahweh said to Israel at Horeb, "You have stayed long enough at this mountain. Turn and take your journey and go to the hill country of the Amorites and to all their neighbors." He actually says this again in chapter 2, verse 3. "Then Yahweh said to me, 'You have been traveling around this mountain country long enough. Turn northward and command the people. You're about to pass through the territory of your brothers.'" So there's a couple of times in Israel's progression towards the promised land where they kind of stall. And Yahweh has to tell Moses, "Okay, that's long enough. Move on." So the first time is at Horeb. In chapter 1, verse 6, the second time is at Seir. And both times, Yahweh says, "You've stayed at this mountain long enough." So this is something that leaders in particular have to be sensitive to. We must always beware of stagnation, the paralysis of analysis. Have you ever known leaders to get caught in that? Or the ivory tower that would trap us in endless theoretical and intellectual pursuits while our participation in the divine plan stalls and the world languishes, waiting for the divine blessing mediated through us. Sometimes God says, "Get moving." Now, who does that? Who marshals the troops and gets them moving? Moses does. Leaders do, right? So Yahweh prods us on to keep moving. We are a people always on the move under Yahweh's direction, and we need leaders who know that and who do that well. Development and delegation is an important motif in a couple of places in Deuteronomy. Beginning in chapter 1, verses 9 through 18, Moses admits that he could not lead the people by himself. And this is where he says, "Then I was commanded by Yahweh to appoint judges." Deuteronomy, interestingly, doesn't mention that this was Jethro's idea. It just mentions the fact that Moses developed and delegated. He developed leaders and then he delegated authority to them. That's basic, but it's important to remember, isn't it? Because otherwise you'll burn yourself out. We've talked about this before, but I just want to hit it again. Beware of developing bitterness toward the people you lead. Now, we saw Moses wrestle with this, didn't we? In chapter 1, verse 37, in chapter 3, verse 26, and in chapter 4, verse 21, three times Moses says, "Yahweh was angry with me because of you." Look, Moses was a man. He was a very good man. He was an exceptional leader. As the book of Hebrews said, he was faithful in all of Yahweh's house, right? But he had, as Everett has so wisely mentioned, he had his dark side. And you see it coming out here. He has bitterness towards God's people, and it comes out. Beware of that. Now, to Moses' credit, he takes care of it and doesn't let it poison his mentoring of Joshua. But it comes out, and we see it. In chapter 5, verses 23 through 27, Moses reviews with the people how he came to have this position. He says, "You know, we were at Sinai, and Yahweh was speaking directly to you, and you couldn't handle it. And so you asked me to go and to speak with Yahweh and then report to you. And so I adopted this position." And I think here Moses does a good job of getting at the heart of leadership, spiritual leadership anyway. Spiritual leadership at its heart is intercessory and mediatory. It means that you are the first to approach God and that you model spiritual intimacy. Now, of course, Yahweh eventually wants all of his people to commune directly with him, but Moses kind of had to pave the way for that, for Israel, and he did so. And then finally, I would just mention that there's a whole sequence, there's a whole section of Deuteronomy that's really dedicated to leadership. It's chapters 16 through chapter 18, where you've got a series of different kinds of leaders appointed by Moses, beginning with judges in Deuteronomy chapter 16. And then, of course, we've talked about the law of the king in Deuteronomy chapter 17. And the crucial text, that is, as far as defining the appropriate use of power in Israel, right? But then there's two more we haven't talked about yet that I want to mention before we conclude our observations on leadership. And that is the priests and the prophets, both of whom are discussed in chapter 18. And just want you to look with me for just a moment at this, because this is interesting. Now, if you look at the handout that was handed, that was given out to you today, because there's a sermon starter there that I want you to notice that relates to both of these, actually. The first one is the contented clergy, which is the second sermon start on the first page. Do you all see that? The contented clergy. It's the second sermon starter on the first page. So it's right here. Right down here. Yeah, the contented clergy. This is what I want to talk to you about here for just a moment, is the way Moses outlines the role of the priest in Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 1 through 8 is very interesting. He says, the Levitical priests, all the tribe of Levi, shall have no portion or inheritance with Israel. They shall eat Yahweh's food offerings as their inheritance. They shall have no inheritance among their brothers. Yahweh is their inheritance, as he promised them. And this shall be the priest's due from the people. From those offering a sacrifice, whether an ox or a sheep, they shall give to the priest the shoulder and the two cheeks and the stomach, the first fruits of your grain, of your wine, and of your oil, and the first fleece of your sheep you shall give him, and so forth. You get the idea. I've always been fascinated about the role that the tribe of Levi plays. Because they didn't get an inheritance the way the other tribes did. And I've always felt that Yahweh was trying to, he was using them as an image, using them as a symbol of what should be true of all Israel. That the relationship is more important than the real estate. The relationship is more important than the real estate. And Levi is a living expression of this because they live lives of deprivation and dependence. They've been deprived of land of their own. So they're always being hosted by their other tribes in their Levitical cities, right? And then their livelihood depends on the tithes and the offerings that the other tribes make. Now, that's not an ideal life for most people, right? Lives of deprivation and dependence. But that's precisely the kind of lives that the Levites live, and by living it, they prove themselves to be a contented clergy. Now, of course, you probably realize that according to 1 Peter, we've all been ordained into the priesthood. So guess what that means? Yahweh is our portion, right? There's a lot of things you're not going to get that other people will. That's okay. Yahweh is your inheritance, right? And so Levi is a marvelous demonstration of this, and that's an important role for leadership to play well, is to model contentment. And that's what the Levites do. So there's some suggestions there for how you might preach that section of Deuteronomy 18 regarding the priests and the critical role they play as a contented clergy. God's priestly people as models of joyful dependence. And then, of course, the second half of Deuteronomy chapter 18 has to do with the prophets. This next kind of leadership that Moses speaks of and launches as he explains how the successions of prophets will work after his death. Yahweh will raise up a prophet like me, he says. So on the back of that sheet you got today, you have one more sermon suggestion. It's called Communication 101, How the Covenant Shapes Our Relationships with God and the World. Because God's main concern here is that Israel avoid the abominable practices of the nations among whom she lives, who practice divination. Now, why do they practice divination? because they want to communicate with the gods, right? But there are some problems with divination. You see, God prohibits communication that is manipulative, impersonal, or mechanistic in order to protect the covenant relationship from deterioration. A succession of prophets culminating in Christ, therefore, models and mediates healthy communication between God and His people. And so there's a number of ideas you can emphasize from this portion of Deuteronomy. You see, Yahweh's main problem with divinatory practices of Israel's neighbors was their manipulative and impersonal character. These were attempts to wrest information from reticent, taciturn deities rather than loving, grateful responses to revelation. There's no need for divination because Yahweh reveals His will to Israel. Remember, we already talked about that. Torah is a grace. So there's no need for this. Divination is based on a fundamental misconception that the gods hide from us what we need to know and that we must outsmart them into giving up some of their prized information. Does that sound familiar? Psst. Do you hear the hiss of the serpent? Well, Yahweh knows that if you eat this fruit, you'll be like God, knowing what He knows. That's divination. Divination is really just the original temptation, isn't it? The desire to know what God knows without getting it from Him. No. Divination will not do. So extispicy, for example, that's one form of divination. Presume that the gods hid information in the entrails of sacrificial animals that only specially trained priests could read. Talk about a fortune cookie.
Yeah.
This was precisely the misunderstanding that the serpent encouraged Eve to adopt in Genesis 3, as we said. So anyway, all that to say that it's not that Yahweh doesn't want Israel to have information. It's that He wants to go about it the right way. Information is Yahweh's to give. It's His to reveal. Deuteronomy 29:29 is a really great principle here. The things that have been revealed are for us and for our children, but the secret things belong to the Lord. And that's why Israel is not permitted to engage in divination. Prophets are the safeguard of that. Prophets are the leaders in Israel that teach Israel how to communicate with Yahweh. Prophecy and prayer, right? Prophecy and prayer. And prophets are perfect models of that. All right, so that's my understanding of how Deuteronomy prepares us for leadership. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this recording from the 2023 Northwest Expositor Seminar. The seminar was directed by Mark Johnson and Jay Hawkins and hosted at beautiful Camp Yamhill in Yamhill, Oregon. I'm your recording host, Kevin Jensen. The Expositor Seminar is partially funded by the Northwest Endowment Fund, which is a legacy of Cascade College and the many people who served and supported its mission. We are very grateful for the commitment that the Endowment Fund has to Churches of Christ in the Pacific Northwest. Hope to see you at next year's seminar.